Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, January 12th, 2022. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Report. Oil, gas paid $15.8 billion in taxes. MISD received $135 million from industry last fiscal year, according to TXOGA. By Mella McEwen. Hard hit in 2020 by the arrival of the global COVID-19 pandemic and oil market crash, Texas's oil and gas industry displayed an economic resurgence in 2021. In the annual Energy and Economic Impact Report the Texas Oil and Gas Association has presented since 2007, the association said the state's energy industry paid $15.8 billion in state and local taxes and state royalties. At the same time, state royalties and production taxes rose by more than 20%. Production taxes exceeded $5 billion for only the third time in history. As our nation continues its rebound from the lingering impact of the pandemic, this data confirms reliable, affordable energy, fuels and products made by the oil industry and natural gas industry are central to continued economic and environmental progress, said TXOGA President Todd Staples in a media call to discuss the report. Just as the West Texas portion of the Permian Basin leads the state in oil and natural gas production and taxes and royalties paid, the region leads in benefiting from those taxes. According to the report, Midland Independent School District topped the list of top 10 school districts receiving oil and natural gas property taxes, receiving $134.9 million in fiscal year 2021. Seven West Texas counties were among the top 10 counties to receive property taxes, led by Reeves County with $47.4 million, or 67.3% of its total tax base. Midland County placed fifth with $18.9 million, or 36.9% of its tax base. That $15.8 billion translates into more than $43 million in state and local taxes and state royalties being paid every day, Staples said. He pointed out that those funds go to support the state's schools and universities, roads, first responders, and other essential service. The Permanent School Fund received $1.099 billion, and the Permanent University Fund, $979 million, while the state's Economic Stabilization Fund, better known as the Rainy Day Fund, received $1.134 billion. Oil and gas royalties are the only source of fresh capital to the PSF and PUS and have been for a century, Staples said. Since 2007, when TXOGA first started compiling this data, the Texas oil and natural gas industry has paid more than $178.7 billion in state and local taxes and state royalties, a figure that does not include the hundreds of billions of dollars in payroll for some of the highest-paying jobs in the state, taxes paid on office buildings and personal property, and the enormous economic ripple effect that benefits other sectors of the economy. In 2021, the industry employed 422,122 Texans who, on average, earned $109,000 each, almost double the average pay compared to other private sectors. And for every direct job in the industry, conservative estimates indicate that an additional 2.2 indirect jobs are created. In total, 1.3 million Texans' jobs ultimately derive from the Texas oil and natural gas industry, according to the report. Beyond the economic impact of the state's energy industry, Staples stressed that investments made by the industry have positioned the United States as the global leader in energy and environmental progress. Methane emissions are down dramatically, even as oil and natural gas production increases. Flaring rates in Texas are at record lows. And Texas-produced LNG is an environmental game-changer for nations around the world, he said. He cited a statistic from the Railroad Commission that the statewide flaring rate in Texas fell to a record low of 0.2% in October. Staples warned that this progress is under assault by federal policies designed deliberately to eliminate the oil and natural gas industry and all of the quality of life, environment, and economic benefits it provides. Our federal government is quite literally standing in the way of global environmental progress. He concluded, "We cannot sacrifice energy freedom for energy dependence. Squandering our nation's energy might, through misguided policy, is a disservice to every American and a step in the wrong direction on the environment." This article is entitled, "Hospital CEO Urges Midland to Get Vaccine." Myers said COVID wave impacting staff at Midland Memorial, by Stuart Doreen. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers reported that for the first time during the pandemic, the percentage of COVID inpatients that are vaccinated topped 20% and is closer to 30%. However, the push for people to get vaccinated continued during the weekly presser as Myers took the data inside Midland Memorial Hospital to also show the vaccination process is still having an impact in Midland. Of those inpatients, only 6% had gone all the way through their particular vaccines and had an additional booster shot, Myers said. The evidence has been mounting for a while that those who have had boosters are best equipped to battle Omicron, either to avoid it altogether or to minimize the symptoms that come along with an Omicron infection. Myers has been a consistent supporter of vaccines during the pandemic, even when there have been local leaders and outspoken people that have been muted or even shouting down the calls for people in Midland to get vaccinated. Myers knows the lack of interest in vaccines inside Midland County, where 44.61% of those 5 years and older and 72.46% of those 65 and older are fully vaccinated. The Department of State Health Services shows those numbers trail the state averages, 61.66% and 83.46% respectively. He said again Tuesday that the COVID outbreak is again impacting the staffing at Midland Memorial. Myers said 102 employees were out on Tuesday and another 90 had meaningful exposure to those infected but are still working because they've tested negative so far. For the second straight week, he asked those just needing a test to avoid coming to the Midland Memorial emergency room, which he said is overwhelmed. He added Tuesday that those with minor symptoms also need to avoid a trip to the ER. Staff members in the ER are taking care of people who are legitimately sick and need their intervention, Myers said. They do not need an additional population there who are not sick or have minimal illness and are just there for a test. Myers, in an attempt to keep Omicron out of Midland Memorial, asked people who have been exposed to not enter as a visitor. If you know you're positive, or if you've been recently exposed to someone who's positive, please do not come to the hospital, Myers said. FaceTime with your loved one. Talk to them on the phone, but don't come in. While other variants impacted MMH in terms of the potency of the virus, Omicron is impacting the hospital because of the transmissibility. Midland Health reports a positivity rate of at least 40% going back 2 weeks. Last week, it was 51.9%. Through Monday of this week, the positivity rate again eclipsed 50%. That added another 126 positive tests just at Midland Health testing centers. The Midland Health Department on Monday showed 494 positive tests, the sixth straight weekday with more than 450 new COVID cases reported inside Midland County. Don't step foot in the hospital and don't go anywhere in the facility without a mask on, Myers said. Myers again was the main messenger on the United Command team call on Tuesday. He reminded those watching on social media that a vaccine clinic is again taking place on Tuesday afternoons at the former West Campus on Andrews Highway. Midland Health Department officials also said they have all three types of vaccines for those interested. Myers said those wanting a free test can get one and that they needed to call 68Nurse to schedule an appointment. Omicron has increased the number of people wanting a test. Myers knows this and asked the community to be patient as MMH staffers are doing the best they can taking care of the call volume. Call 68Nurse or simply stay home if your symptoms are minor, Myers said. Stay home, rest, push fluids, stay away from other people. Treat it just like you would any other viral illness. Take care of yourself at home. And if your symptoms get worse, if you can't breathe, if you have more aggressive symptoms that require intervention, please do come to the ER. But don't come there if your symptoms are minor or if you just want a test. He reminded those on the call that Midland Health will again reopen its monoclonal antibody treatment center when the hospital receives the infusion treatment that has proven to work against the Omicron variant. As of today, we don't have the drug, Myers said, and so we can't predict when that infusion operation might return. We'll get it going as soon as we can. So finally, just to close my remarks, if you have any thought at all about being vaccinated, please do so. It is very clear at this point. There is no better defense against this disease than to be vaccinated and boosted when the opportunity comes. It doesn't mean you won't get it, but it does mean you're much less likely to be really sick, and you're much more likely to recover quickly. This article is entitled I-14 Connections to Benefit Midland Industry. Motran director says connecting vital infrastructure will expand opportunities. By Stuart Doreen. Interstate 14 will connect two areas of the country that can benefit each other. That was part of the message from Midland-Odessa Transportation Alliance Executive Director James Beecham on the approved corridor that will connect West Texas with the southeastern portion of the U.S., states like Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, and its region's ports. Beecham told those at the Permian Basin Petroleum Museum's lunch and lecture on Tuesday that there are spheres of influence with that area of the country. Certainly, there are the military bases that will be part of the Interstate 14 path. As Beecham said after the event, the number one consumer in America of petroleum products is the United States Department of Defense. But he told those in attendance the opportunities don't stop there. He provided some insight about the connections to ports along the Gulf Coast, specifically Savannah, Georgia, which is the third largest port system in America, according to Beecham, and home to infrastructure in place that can accommodate an oil and gas region. All of those ports, there's a significant portion of their business model that runs on energy, Beecham said, whether that's exporting energy or just the energy that's necessary at those ports for refuel and ships and things of that nature. When you have spent time at the port of Savannah or the port of Charleston, and you're talking to these folks and they're talking about how they're receiving chemical shipments from abroad that are then being railed over into the Permian Basin, they know exactly where the Permian Basin is. It's part of their business model. When you're in Alexandria, Louisiana, and you're watching Interstate 49 going north and south, and seeing trucks that say Midland and Odessa on them hit those Gulf Coast ports, you just realize what a small world it is and how this really does go together. The addition of the western leg of Interstate 14 was a political marvel as well, Beecham told those at the monthly lunch and lecture. He said the bipartisan efforts of U.S. Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Raphael Warnock of Georgia allowed for an amendment to include Midland-Odessa, while also extending the eastern segment across Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. Had Raphael Warnock not been for that amendment, it would not have come up on the Senate floor, Beecham said. I-14, Beecham said, will be about the opportunities that help Midland moving forward, even if highway infrastructure isn't put together right away. He used an example of Waha Hub gas pipeline built into Mexico. He said there wasn't much of an impact right away, but that the natural gas shipments into Mexico have increased by 1 billion cubic feet a day. Having that baseline infrastructure allows the markets to develop, Beecham said. We have a commodity that sometimes people don't realize. And being able to access markets like Europe or Asian Pacific markets ultimately allows us to get higher prices that help pay for capturing and collecting that. We couldn't afford to do that economically or viably based on the price here. But those prices then make it viable. And simply by making that connectivity for natural gas, you're able to take our economy and in essence double it. That's amazing. And the baseline is already here. The production's already occurring. It's just making sure that infrastructure matches the needs. Beecham also told those in attendance that resources eventually will come to Midland to help with regional road projects, including the construction of South Loop 250 and improvements to Highway 158 from Sterling City to Midland. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled Oman, OPEC Plus Hike Enough to Avoid Overheat, by Salma El-Wardani and Grant Smith, Bloomberg. OPEC and its allies don't want crude prices to climb to $100 a barrel and are reviving production quickly enough to prevent global markets from overheating, Oman's oil minister said. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies, a 23-nation group led by Saudi Arabia and Russia, continues to restore output halted during the pandemic at a gradual pace of 400,000 barrels a day. Though, in practice, its increases have been restricted by internal unrest and depressed budgets. Crude prices have rallied this year, topping $80 a barrel in London. We're very careful at OPEC Plus. We will look at each month as we go, Omani Oil Minister Mohammed Al-Rumbi said in an interview in Riyadh. But so far, I think 400,000 is good because demand is increasing and we want to make sure that the market is not overheating. We don't want to see $100 a barrel. The world is not ready for that. Oil's rally has alarmed many consuming nations as it stokes inflationary pressure that's menacing the world's economic recovery from the pandemic. Part of the problem has been a crunch in global production capacity following a run of reduced spending, Al-Rumhi said. Over the past 5 years, investments have been limited in the industry and we're paying the price for it now, Al-Rumhi said. It's an issue afflicting OPEC Plus themselves. OPEC made only part of its planned output increase last month as Nigeria and Libya were beset by disruptions. Many members of the wider coalition, such as Angola and Malaysia, are also seeing production falter because of diminished investment. Even Russia struggled to boost volumes last month. This article is entitled Shale Growth to Drive Record in U.S. Crude Output Next Year, by Sheila Tobin, Bloomberg. U.S. annual oil production is set to rise to a record next year as shale producers continue to boost output.
oil supply will average 12.41 million barrels a day in 2022, according to the Energy Information Administration. That would surpass the current annual high of 12.3 million barrels a day set in 2019, the EIA said in its monthly short-term energy outlook report. The agency also lowered its production estimate for this year to 11.8 million barrels a day. The projected rise in U.S. output would represent 9 consecutive quarters of growth, beginning the last 3 months of 2021, the EIA said. U.S. crude production reached a monthly peak in late 2019, months before the pandemic jolted global markets and forced producers to slash output. Since then, oil prices have recovered by more than 50%, but major producers have been wary of bringing back supplies too quickly, keeping monthly figures below pre-pandemic highs. Relatively high crude oil prices should result in an ample availability of funding to support the production increase, the EIA said in the monthly report. The agency sees domestic output surpassing 12 million barrels a day from the fourth quarter of this year. Benchmark U.S. crude futures prices have been off to a strong start to the year, adding over $5 a barrel since 2021 ended. The agency also sees global petroleum supply rising to a record this year of 101.05 million barrels a day. That's an upward revision from last month's forecast of 100.93 million. The EIA expects global production will rise further to 102.8 billion barrels a day in 2023. Global consumption is set to reach 100.52 million barrels a day this year from its previous estimate of 100.46 million, according to the report. Consumption is expected to jump to 102.3 million barrels a day in 2023. This article is entitled "Oil Field Services Sector Added Thousands of Jobs Last Month" by Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. The oil field services sector added 7,450 jobs in December, up 1% from November, as crude prices continue to recover from the pandemic-driven downturn. Employment in the oilfield services and equipment sector increased by 62,163 jobs in 2021, posting gains every month since February, and recovering a little more than half of the 109,000 jobs lost during the pandemic in 2020, according to an analysis of the Bureau of Labor Statistics data by the Energy Workforce and Technology Council. The Houston-based trade group represents oilfield services firms that drill and complete wells and manufacture equipment, including Halliburton, Schlumberger, and Baker Hughes. Coronavirus vaccines and the resulting surge in economic activity has bolstered hiring in the oil patch, particularly in the Permian Basin of West Texas and New Mexico, the nation's most productive oil field. Texas added 21,924 oil field service jobs over the past year, the most nationally. There are 321,304 oil field service workers in the Lone Star State, representing nearly half of the nation's workforce, according to the Energy Workforce and Technology Council. Jobs in the sector, however, remain well below pre-pandemic levels. The sector employs 659,356 employees nationally, down from 786,532 workers at the pre-pandemic peak of June 2019. And 732,430 workers in December 2019, when the novel coronavirus was first discovered in China. Still, the job recovery is welcome news to the oilfield services sector, one of the hardest hit during the 2020 oil bust. Many oil exploration and production companies, which contract with oilfield services firms, temporarily stop drilling wells and producing oil and natural gas from existing wells at the start of the pandemic, as demand for crude and petroleum products plunged. Employment reached a low in February at 591,413 jobs, down nearly 12% since the pandemic in the U.S. began in March 2020. During the worst period of pandemic-related cuts, oilfield services companies slashed almost 57,300 jobs in April 2020, when crude prices fell into negative territory for the first time. It was the largest job loss recorded in the sector in a single month since at least 2013. Since then, the rollout of vaccines has lifted economic lockdowns and travel bans across the globe, although Omicron threatens renewed restrictions. Production cuts by OPEC and Western oil giants have also buoyed crude markets, allowing demand for crude and petroleum products such as gasoline and jet fuel to catch up with supply and raising prices. West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. crude benchmark, was trading at $78.16 a barrel on Monday morning, down 74 cents from Friday, but up from negative $37 a barrel in April 2020. U.S. drillers added 235 rigs in 2021, but the number of rigs in operation remains far below the peak of almost 1,100 at the end of 2018 and the 790 rigs operating pre-pandemic, according to Baker Hughes. The rig count is a leading indicator of the nation's oil and gas production and oil field jobs.
Obituaries. James Edward Jerkins, Odessa, Texas. James Edward Jerkins, July 18, 1947 to December 6, 2021. On Monday, December 6, 2021, Ed Jenkins passed away at Medical Center Hospital of stomach cancer. He was born in Castleberry, Atlanta, to Henry and Jesse Jerkins. On March 14, 1965, he married Ruth Kirkland. They had two sons, Donald Ray and Stephen James. After his first marriage ended, he met Christy Contreras in January 1994. They were married September 26, 1997, and remained together till his death. He was preceded in death by his father, Henry, mother, Jesse, brothers, Edward, Ray, William, Johnny, Jean, sisters, Lula Dean Raines, and Elaine Jerkins. He is survived by his wife, Christy of Odessa, sons, Donald and Cora, Stephen and his wife, Leanne, stepson, Mike Lingoria, stepdaughter, Kathy Morgeson, sisters, Melissa Ballard, Henrietta Wilson, Mary Terrell, seven grandchildren, and six great-grandchildren. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, January 15, 2022, at Martinez Funeral Home. In lieu of flowers, please make donations to a charity of your choice. Sally Salgado Gomez, Odessa. Sally Salgado Gomez, 61, of Odessa, Texas, passed away peacefully at her home on January 7, 2022, in Odessa. Viewing and rosary will be Thursday, January 13th, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. Rosary at 7 p.m. at Martinez Funeral Home. Mass will be Friday, January 14th at 2 p.m. with Father Chavez of St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home. Sally was born in Odessa, Texas, to Thomas and Rosie Salgado on February 10, 1960. She is preceded in death by her parents, her siblings, Hector, Juan, and Sylvia, Sally is survived by her children, Christy Gomez, and husband Jose Marian Montes, Luis Gomez, Christopher Salgado, John Gomez, and wife Jennifer Villarreal. 5 grandchildren. Her brothers and sisters, Nettie, Betty, Anna, Rosalinda, Lily, Thomas, Henry, and Alfredo Salgado, and several nieces and nephews and friends. Death notices. Lydia Ann Jones, Odessa. Lydia Ann Jones, 67, died Saturday, January 8th in Midland, Texas. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home. Lawrence W. Larry Lamb, Big Spring. Larry Lamb, 87, of Odessa, died Tuesday in Big Spring. Graveside service is scheduled for 10 a.m. January 13th at Ector County Cemetery. Arrangements are by Frank W. Wilson Funeral Home. Manuel Lopez, Odessa. Manuel Lopez, 82, of Odessa, died Thursday, January 6th in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 10 a.m. January 14th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Jesusita Esperanza Lujan, Midland. Jesusita Esperanza Lujan, 87, of Odessa, died Sunday, January 9th in Midland. Mass will be celebrated at 2 p.m. Thursday, January 13th at Joseph's Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Ector County Cemetery, the Peaceful Garden Sections. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home. Irene Jeanette Peters McCain, Odessa. Irene Jeanette Peters McCain, 94, of Odessa, died Thursday, January 6th in Odessa. Funeral service was scheduled for 10 a.m. Tuesday, January 11th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Sheila Swift Moore, Odessa. Sheila Swift Moore, 87, of Odessa, died Monday, January 3rd in Odessa. Celebration of life is scheduled for 10 a.m. on Saturday, January 15th at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home. This is Connie reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, January 12th, 2022. Odessa Foundling Touts Safe Haven Law by Michael Bauer. A woman who was abandoned in Odessa at birth has made it her mission to share awareness about safe haven laws, which can make a life or death difference to an unwanted newborn. Kristen Winchester was abandoned at a 7-Eleven in Odessa in August 1989, just shortly after being born, and was discovered by a clerk in the bed of a truck. A woman called the store and told the clerk to go check because she had seen someone place something, Winchester said. Basically, that's how someone found me. They found me in the back of the truck, and after that, I was named Baby Girl Doe. Like Odessa's baby girl Doe, a newborn boy was saved over the weekend in Hobbs, New Mexico, after being found inside a bag of trash in a dumpster by several Hobbs residents who were dumpster diving. Grown up now, Winchester has told her story in her blog titled Baby Girl Doe, which can be found at babygirldoe.wordpress.com. She also has a podcast in which her story will be told and also talks to people from similar situations. Winchester on Tuesday via phone talked about her podcast titled Born a Secret. A foundling is an infant abandoned and raised by someone else besides their mother or father. Each episode of the podcast covers a foundling's unique story of how they coped with life as a foundling and their pursuit to find out why their life started the way it did. So far, 3 episodes of the podcast have come out, with a 4th coming out soon. The podcast can be accessed at BornASecretBuzzSprout.com. I have a blog where I've been telling the truth of what happened for years now, Winchester said. I have a podcast that's about other foundlings that have been in similar situations in which they were abandoned as infants and were searching for their parents. It's really about finding where they came from and their birth mother. Winchester, whose maiden name is Brown, grew up in Springfield, Missouri. After learning of her story growing up, Winchester would eventually learn who her birth parents were through genetic genealogy in a search process that took a couple of years. My story is different from others, Winchester said while talking about her podcast. My birth mother despised me. I was like the boogeyman coming back. I wasn't going to not get answers. I felt like I was owed them. I couldn't move on with my life until I learned what happened. I did something that most people may not have done, and I don't know that I did the right thing. But I did what I had to. The first 3 episodes are other foundling stories. My episode will come up soon, but the moral of it is it didn't have to be the way that my birth mother made it. It didn't have to be that terrible situation. If you hear the first 3 episodes, the mothers don't have to be the villains. They don't have to be the bad person. I'm sorry that a woman in distress who's pregnant alone, like, I'm sure that's hard to go through. But at the end of the day, I hope my story is have compassion, and hopefully that's how a birth mother won't act in the future and won't treat someone in the future. The safe haven law was highlighted Monday by law enforcement in Hobbs, New Mexico, after they arrested 18-year-old Alexis Avila for attempted murder after police say she threw her newborn son away in a dumpster at the Broadmoor Shopping Center. A video of the teen throwing the infant into the trash has been shared more than a million times. The baby survived and is recovering at a Lubbock hospital. Hobbs police, during a Monday news conference, said the teen confessed and that her parents were unaware she was pregnant. During the emotional press conference, police praised the quick work of those who found the newborn and immediately called 911 and kept the baby warm until help arrived. The baby could have been left at a hospital or fire or police station under the safe haven law. Part of Winchester's podcast includes making the safe haven law better known and understood. The law allows a parent to anonymously surrender their unharmed infant to a designated safe haven provider within a specific time after birth. That's part of the podcast, Winchester said. In the show, we raise awareness for the safe haven law. That's part of the mission. I've always been an advocate for the safe haven law. More information on the National Safe Haven Alliance can be found at nationalsafe-havenalliance.org. Top Lawmaker Stops by OC by Ruth Campbell. Texas House Speaker Dade Feland got to do one of the things he likes best about his job, Tuesday, traveled the state. One of his stops was Odessa College. The Beaumont Republican heard presentations from OC administrators and met other OC officials, plus Ector County ISD Superintendent Scott Murray and Odessa Collegiate Academy Principal James Ramage in the Zaint Room of the Salisbury Campus Center. They were going to take a tour of the campus but ran out of time because Fleland's flight was delayed. Fleland was also going to an Odessa Chamber of Commerce function Tuesday and stopping in Midland as well. Republican Brooks Landgraf of Odessa invited the speaker. "Honestly, it's one of the best parts of the job is to be able to travel the state. We have a lot in common, but there's a lot of differences, different challenges, different goals. It's important to get out there in Brooks' community and understand what Odessa is facing. What are their wants? What are their desires? And it's better done face-to-face," Fleland said. He'll be traveling around the state the rest of the week and make stops in Amarillo and other spots in between next week. "It's important to get with my colleagues, understand what legislation they need, what financing they need. Every community college is different. Their challenges are different, so it's important to travel the state. That's part of the job. It's great. Brooks and I came in 2015, and he does a tremendous job for the community, and he tended the invitation. I couldn't say no," Fleland added. Murray said it was beneficial to attend Tuesday's presentation and learn more of what Odessa College is doing. "We should be proud as a community that education is that important, that we're all working, K-12 higher education, to make good things happen for people in our community," Murray said. He said Fleland's visit is similar to Murray visiting a school. "When an issue comes up, I've been there, done that. I've met the people. I know the situation, and so context matters, and when our elected officials are part of the environment, they get to know the people and see the environment. When things make it to the state level, from a decision-making perspective, that gives them context to make really wise choices. So visits like these are very important, absolutely," Murray said. During presentations by Odessa College officials, they pointed out their accomplishments, goals, awards, partnerships, programs, and degrees. "We were one of the very few colleges that remained open and fully staffed to support students and their families in pursuit of their educational goals," said Vice President for Student Services Kim McKay. "As a result, in 2021, this fall, the Coordinating Board awarded Odessa College one of the Star Awards because of our response to the pandemic." Referring to a slide, McKay said the response to the pandemic resulted in record enrollments, serving well over 7,000 students, and a continued success rate that students in Odessa have experienced since 2011. "It was because we created a safe space to live, learn, work, and play that our students did so well. Another thing that we were able to do during the pandemic, which we think is really remarkable, that will continue to help us increase the educational attainment level in the region and continue to meet the workforce needs, is raise over $40 million to support a new four-story health science building that will have a simulation hospital on the first floor in partnership with our local medical center health system, ensuring that we are preparing healthcare workers for the future, McKay said. Chief of Staff Robert Rivas said they have 8,000 students this semester and they are aiming for 10,000. Rivas said this is meant to serve more students in the community. And it's what has become the foundation for what we now call Vision 2030 Plus. So we're looking over the next 8 years to get 10,000, he said. Vision 2030 Plus is built on five key areas, Rivas said. We've got health, we've got workforce, we've got teacher education and transfer programs. We've got community wellness, and we've got the campus infrastructure. What does it take for us to actually support that here on our campus to grow to that level? He added. Rivas gave an overview of each of the areas and the need for them. Officials also talked about the Aspen Institute's recognition of OC, making it one of the top community colleges in the country. Its 8-week courses, drop rate improvement program, scholarships, financial aid, and food pantry, among other things. Affidavit: Man charged after admitting to shooting wife, by OA News. An Ector County Sheriff's Office probable cause affidavit detailed a 35-year-old Odessa man was arrested after he admitted to 911 and to investigators that he had shot his wife. Samuel Adrian Chavara, 35, was charged with murder, a first-degree felony. ECSO deputies responded January 8th to the 1100 block of Layla Lane, and while en route, an additional 911 call came in and the man advised that he had shot his wife, the affidavit detailed. When deputies arrived, they located Chavara and two juveniles standing out in the front yard. Deputies entered the house and found a woman dead on the master bedroom floor entryway, and she was face up with a wound to the right shoulder. The woman was identified as Arlie Sotelo Navarrete. The probable cause affidavit detailed that deputies saw a shell casing on the floor 5 feet away. Deputies secured the residence and waited for the arrival of CID investigators. Deputies say that investigators conducted an investigation and located a .22 caliber pistol and shell casings. Investigators also interviewed Chavara, and he admitted to shooting Navarrete. Chavara was booked into Ector County Law Enforcement Center on January 8th, jail records show. He had one bond totaling $250,000 and posted bail on January 10th. Also from the front page, Internet Company Makes Case to County by Kim Smith. When the Con Ector Task Force study asked local families whether they had internet, 1 in 4 said they couldn't afford it or didn't have access to it. More than 20% of those who had it said it was of low quality. A Midland-based internet provider is hoping to help out. During Tuesday's Ector County Commissioner's Court meeting, Mitchell Block, owner of NetOps Communications, told commissioners his company would like to use a portion of Ector County's $32 million of coronavirus relief funds to lay high-speed fiber optic lines in areas of Ector County that don't have adequate internet capabilities. If the commissioners agree, Block said his company would, in exchange, offer disadvantaged families a discount on their internet bill and the equipment they need. In some instances, families could receive the internet at no charge at all, he said. NetOps is not only reaching out to Ector County, but also to the city of Odessa and the Ector County Independent School District to form a public-private partnership, Block said. Outside the city of Odessa, there is a district shortage of internet services, and what does exist isn't very good, Block said after the meeting. When the pandemic struck, those issues became even more obvious, especially in households with children forced to participate in distance learning. He said his company began looking at the possibilities of expanding services in South Odessa, Gardendale, Goldsmith, and West Odessa around the start of the pandemic, investing $100,000 in studies, designs, and engineering, Block said. According to their studies, Block told the commissioners there are more than 16,000 households they can provide internet services to in those areas, but that doesn't include the potential homes and businesses that will be served in the future as the area grows. Improving internet connectivity in those areas would not only allow more students to participate in distance learning, if necessary, but it would make it possible for people with minor ailments to seek prescriptions or advice from their doctors through telehealth visits, and more people to work from home, including stay-at-home moms, Block said. It would also make businesses more competitive with improved communications and new sales markets, he said. Internet providers haven't reached outside of the city limits because of the expense in doing so. But with the coronavirus money available, now is the time to do so, Block said. His company is ahead of the game because they've already spent the last 2 years working on the designs and engineering, Block said. Other companies that haven't started will be hampered by supply chains and chip shortage issues, he said. In addition, NetOps is working with the Odessa Development Corporation so it can hire 20 more full-time employees to maintain the network, Block said. He'll be appearing before the Odessa City Council next week to talk about his company and the possibility of a private-public partnership. In other business, the commissioners heard a presentation from Griff Gleason, Director of Client Services for Forensic Medical Management, a Tennessee-based company interested in leasing space locally to conduct autopsies for the county. The county is currently sending remains to Lubbock for autopsies when the person died alone and or the cause and manner of death are unknown. County Judge Debbie Hayes said the county is spending between $400,000 and $500,000 a year for the private company's services. Gleason said 133 autopsies were performed for Ector County last year, and roughly 400 are conducted in the Permian Basin annually. More than 1,000 are performed in the area if Abilene and other West Texas towns are included. Creating a forensics center in the area would be highly beneficial, especially since there are so few board-certified forensic pathologists in the United States, and there is the possibility Texas Tech's Health Science Center could potentially launch a teaching program, Gleason said. There are only 500 board-certified forensic pathologists in the United States, and a recent research article said there's a need for 1,300 to 1,400, Gleason said. He's noted that if the county were to create a facility, the cost would come back in the form of a lease from Forensic Medical Management. Quick hits. Free COVID-19 PCR tests. The City of Odessa Incident Command is partnering with Curative to offer the COVID-19 PCR test drive-through from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday at the corner of 2nd Street and Grant Avenue. Insurance information will be requested. If no insurance, tests will be free. To book an appointment, visit curative.com. COVID-19 Vaccination Clinic. The Ector County Health Department, 211 North Texas Avenue, has scheduled a COVID-19 vaccine clinic from 8:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. and from 1:30 p.m. to 4 p.m. Thursday. First and second doses for ages 12 and older, and boosters only for 16 ages and older will be available. For more information, call 432-498-4141. The Sand Hills Stock Show and Rodeo. The Sand Hills Stock Show and Rodeo have been scheduled through Saturday at the Ector County Coliseum, 4201 Andrews Highway. Rodeo performances start at 7:30 p.m. For tickets and full schedule of events, visit sandhillssr.com. Storytime and Crafts to Go. The Ector County Library Children's Department has scheduled Storytime and Crafts to Go at 4 p.m. Thursday at the third floor auditorium at the library, 321 West 5th Street. Annual Livestock Show and Sale. The Midland County Livestock Association has scheduled the Midland County 7th Annual Livestock Show and Sale through Saturday at the Midland County Horseshoe Arena, 2514 Arena Trail, Midland. Read to Felix. The Ector County Library Children's Department has scheduled Read to Felix at 4 p.m. Thursdays at the third floor auditorium at the library, 321 West 5th Street. Felix is a therapy dog that loves to be read to. One Book Odessa Launch. The Ellen Noel Art Museum, 4909 East University Boulevard, has scheduled One Book Odessa Launch at 6 p.m. Thursday. Odessa Arts and the Ellen Noel Art Museum will announce the 2022 lineup for the authors at the Ector Speaker Series. Odessa native and best-selling author Elizabeth Wetmore will be presented February 10th at the Ector Theater. Learn more about her book, Valentine, and the book club events leading up to her visit. There's also a chance to win a free copy of the book and tickets to the event. Mamma Mia Sing-Along. The Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center, 1310 North Farm to Market 1788 in Midland, has scheduled Cinema Under the Stars featuring Mamma Mia Sing-Along at 7:30 p.m. Thursday. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. Costumes representing character from Mamma Mia are welcome. Tickets are free. For tickets and costume guidelines, visit WagnerNoel.com.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.